This is Games as a Podcast, hosted by Chris and Ethan. We're two Sega alums that love talking about the past, present, and future of games, and the industry that makes them. Each week, we explore a gaming topic,
often mixing in our perspectives from our time at Big Blue and beyond. And some weeks, we'll have a guest, usually someone whose career has crossed ours. We talk about their own experiences and perspectives as well.
Hey, Ethan, how's it going?
Hey, Chris. Good, good. I'm so glad we're finally doing this. So, a little context for people who are tuning in. We worked together for about 13 years or so.
Yes.
Doesn't feel like it was that long because it was a pretty exciting time and time moved fast. What I really was excited about was getting a chance to come on and ask you some questions about the time you were at Sega before I was, right?
I was.
So you were there during the Dreamcast era. I came in roughly when Sonic Heroes came out, so during the PlayStation 2, Xbox, GameCube era. So there's a lot of stuff that I was experiencing when you were there as a just hardcore player. And so that's kind of what I wanted to jump into next in terms of like consoles and innovation and things that really move the needle, because I remember when I was a player going from that jump from Nintendo 64, right? First time you ever saw Mario in 3D, and you know, the PlayStation 1 with Ridge Racer and Final Fantasy 7 and all that, to Dreamcast. And you know, there were a lot of people who skipped Dreamcast and went right to PlayStation 2. But if you were really a hardcore gamer, like the first time you'd see something like Sonic Adventure running, that looked so much better than Super Mario 64. And we can argue which mechanically was better as an overall game. But in terms of whiz-bang, like, my God, I've never seen anything like that before, right? Mm-hmm. When I saw running at an import shop for the very first time, Sega Dreamcast with Sonic Adventure and that whale chasing Sonic and just blasting over all of the, you know, the wooden architecture.
The pier, yeah.
The pier, right, trying to capture him. And then he's doing like loop-de-loops and everything just looks so crisp and everything's moving so fast.
So smooth.
I couldn't believe what I was seeing, right?
Yeah, it was like the first time for me that the gameplay matched the promise of the box cover, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is there was so much pent up excitement for Sonic because, of course, with Saturn, the generation prior, Sonic Team focused on Knights. There was not a proper Sonic game that came out. And so now they're back. They're doing something big. It's going to be a launch game. And again, at this import shop, it wasn't just looking at videos. I could actually get my hands on and play it. And I was mesmerized. You know, the guy who ran the shop could see that I was totally into it. Probably saw there was a future sale there, right? But he said, oh, check this out. And then he popped in Soul Calibur. And that, again, it's like, okay, I'd played Soul Calibur in the arcade, but this looked better,
yep,
right? This was the coolest looking fighter I'd ever seen, and it was 60 frames a second. It was just butter. It just was so, so fun to play. And he indulged me. We played for about a half hour. Now, this was at a time where I was working, you know, just a retail job. I was making probably $8 an hour or something like that, right? And nonetheless, I had taken the money I had saved and 2 days later came back and gave him $700 for a Dreamcast with one controller, one copy of Virtua Fighter 3 TB, and Sonic Adventure. That's all I could afford. It was all in Japanese, right? You know, I brought it back and I was playing Sonic Adventure, and it was great until the cutscenes happened where they were explaining what the hell to do,
yep,
you know, when you weren't running fast. And so back then, you know, you didn't have like easy access YouTube guides and stuff like that. So it was a lot of kind of trial and error. But still, I was playing Dreamcast, right? And I was playing it at home. And I remember I had a friend come over that was also into games, and he was blown away too. It was a little awkward because he had just had a birthday party, and I told him I didn't have any money to get him a present. But, you know, he got to see why, yeah, at least.
you let him play for a little while. That was his present.
I let him play, right? It was mesmerizing. So you were at Sega at the time I was fanboying out here. What was it like, first of all, when you were starting to see in office Dreamcast games for the first time?
Yeah, well, I started a month after launch, so they were fairly ubiquitous when I got there. But I have to tell you, Ethan, there are times when you look back at your career and you realize that certain portions of it were really special. And my time at Sega, I feel very fortunate to have such a long stretch of special time while working at Sega. I was living in San Francisco during the dot-com boom/bust, and I was cold called by a recruiter while I was working for a .bomb. It was really hard for me to believe that Sega reached out to me. You know, being a lifelong gamer, it was pretty awesome. In relatively little time, I interviewed and was working as a technical producer. So I was supporting the launch of the Dreamcast essentially from a customer service perspective. My remit was working on the online knowledge base and the IVR/phone line phone tree. So if you have a problem, you dial in 1-800 USA Sega, I think, something like that, and to get support, and then eventually would kick you to a phone support if you needed it. And I was working on the frontline marketing team, which is just a fancy term for customer service. So we were a small team, especially for a company, you know, launching a console to the masses. There were just three people on the team, I think. And so we were very scrappy. And I think in terms of the larger company, frenetic would be a word that comes to mind in terms of the atmosphere. So there's just a lot of moving parts, the marketing, the publishing, the hardware aspect, the software aspect. Certainly the launch was a huge event, but then you have to sustain that. You've got the titles, the catalogs coming out on a pretty constant cadence. So it was a lot of fun. The place was just buzzing. You know, there were huge marketing efforts, not to mention just the palpable excitement of every, you know, releasing such an amazing piece of hardware. So I think everyone really believed it was great, great technology that was released and great games, most importantly. So there's a lot of great energy, positive energy around being the kind of scrappy, edgy underdog compared to the, you know, behemoth that is Sony. And that's something, you know, being an underdog, I think it's something I always appreciated about working at Sega across numerous years being there. And that's just pretty special time.
Well, so then, you know, stepping back a bit, I know the Genesis was most popular in the U.S., right?
Yep.
Much as I understand it, to the consternation of some folks in Japan. And then when Saturn came out, that was clearly more popular in Japan. So you have now Dreamcast coming out. What was that balance for U.S. versus Japan? Like, which territory was the flagship territory, if there was one? And what was learned from the Saturn launch just before?
So not having been around for the Saturn days, maybe my insight is secondhand, or at least, well, definitely not firsthand. So as you said, the Saturn was very popular in Japan. It was the most successful console at the time for Sega, and the least successful in the West. So certainly there was probably some tension in terms of the console Dreamcast needing to succeed in the West, just because the Saturn had done so poorly. So I think maybe two or three lessons are top of mind for me in terms of things Sega acknowledged and made a concerted effort to change as relates to the Sega launch, Saturn launch versus the Dreamcast launch. First one would be games available at launch. The Saturn had, I think, six titles maybe for launch in the US. Fairly anemic launch from a title perspective. Certainly Virtua Fighter was a really impressive title. But other than that, not a ton there. Dreamcast had 19 at launch, and including some real bangers. So you're talking about Soul Calibur, which was just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
First time you pick that up and play Soul Calibur, you're just blown away. How much fun it is, how smooth it is, just a great game. One of the things I love about it is that it really satisfied more casual players and sophisticated players.
Yeah.
So the best players knew all the combos and just knew all the cancels and stuff. But someone who's never played a fighting game could pick it up and have a really kind of fun experience because just the way the game was designed and built. So I think that was really compelling.
Well, and just walking around a person in 3D and then just finding the right moment to grab them.
Yeah.
That was a very easy thing for, as you said, just about anyone to figure out. So it had a high ceiling of skill.
Yeah.
You could get very, very good at it. But it also moved away from those kind of very difficult to master, like quarter circle punch type of movements, right?
I agree. Then NFL 2K, you know, online connectivity, just fantastic game. Power Stone, Sonic Adventure. So some really, really compelling titles at launch. And like you said, you know, Sonic at launch was huge or an important thing. And then the second thing would be the price point. You know, the Saturn at launch was $399. That's in 1995, which is over $800 in today's money. So it was a very expensive proposition. So if you're a hardcore Sega fan, yes, you were going to shell out, but most Americans didn't go for it. Dreamcast was $199 at launch, which is about $370 today. So less than half the cost of the Saturn. So that was a super important lesson that they learned, and I think was the right decision to make.
Yeah, what an aggressively friendly price. Could have had a very strong argument for $299 easily, but that put it within striking distance, and I would imagine allowed more people to buy more of those launch titles too.
Yeah, and then from a marketing perspective, $199 on $9999, there's a lot of nines there. It kind of segues into the third point, which would be marketing. The Saturn wasn't particularly well marketed, I don't think, especially in the West. And Sega made a consistent effort to ramp up the marketing efforts with the launch of the Dreamcast. So you have very expensive kind of tie-ins, promotions, sponsorships of, you know, global tours, national tours, etc. And not to mention the launch videos. I don't know if you remember those at the time. There was a lot of CG, which was quite expensive at the time. Mm-hmm. So they made some really, really cool commercials for the launch, which were not cheap at all. So I think there was definitely realization that the Saturn didn't really get off on the right foot, and they tried to correct those with the launch of the Dreamcast.
Yeah, I just will never forget the It's Thinking campaign.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah.
It's a funny anecdote. So someone had a bunch of sweatshirts made up that said "Still Thinking" on the back of it for just kind of internal Sega swag. And during the leaner times at Sega, where people would have to say goodbye, we'd often meet up at a place called the Mars Bar, which you're no stranger to, I'm sure.
Yep.
And I once had the idea of fastening a DR in front of the TH of thinking, so it would be still drinking, because we would just be at Mars drinking a lot.
That's great. Yeah, I do have one of those old sweatshirts in my closet. Yeah, that's a great way to kind of connect people during an otherwise kind of sad moment.
Yeah.
The other thing was third-party support, which was interesting. Like, you know, even at the start, there were some people that invested heavily into Sega at that time. I remember picking up a lot of Midway games, like mm-hmm. Ready to Rumble and Hydro Thunder and NFL Blitz, which, by the way, that was like so much fun with four people at home with the Dreamcast, right? And at the time, it's like, oh, cool, the Dreamcast has four ports for four controllers. PlayStation 2, we already knew that was only going to have two, right? So mm-hmm. Looked like, in the very least, if you wanted like the best party machine, you were going to want to have the Dreamcast. But EA didn't come to the party.
They did not.
Which is really a bummer. What happened there? Do you have any sense of where it broke down? Because obviously that was a big, big deal.
Yeah, it was a big deal. And I think a lot of people credit or use that, the fact that EA did not release any titles for the Dreamcast to be a major reason why the console did not succeed. And I think that's a valid argument. My understanding is that EA wanted exclusive rights for sports, which was just something that was not possible for Sega, especially since they bought Visual Concepts explicitly to develop titles like NFL 2K and NBA 2K. So it was kind of a non-starter. So they were just at loggerheads and could not reach an agreement. And it's unfortunate, but...
Well, it is interesting that a few years later, I remember when NFL 2K3 came out on Xbox, and we were at Sega selling that thing for $20, and it was getting better reviews in Game Informer than Madden. That was causing some headaches over for Team EA. That was kind of fun to see, but...
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, but it was great that Capcom supported them. Resident Evil Code Veronica was there exclusively. Street Fighter 3 was exclusive to Dreamcast, which considering how big Street Fighter 2 was, that was a pretty exciting get, right?
Yep.
What I remember the Dreamcast most for was its crazy, wildly creative first-party games. Like stuff that you just wonder, how the hell did this get greenlit? Seaman, right? Which not only was a bizarre idea, but required a pack-in microphone, right?
Yep.
You know, Samba de Amigo, again, wild idea with a required peripheral.
Not required, but highly recommended. You could play it with a controller.
That's
it's just
fair.
not as fun.
Typing of the Dead, though, again, like, you know, the keyboard. What other company would funnel resources into making games like that? And who were they for? I love them. They were definitely for me. There's no doubt about that. But it's like I was somebody who's buying import machines just because I couldn't wait a year, right?
Right.
So that's not a very big audience. So, like, you know, who outside of, like, the super core were playing such wildly experimental games?
Well, Space Channel 5 again. There's definitely some wacky games out there. D3 was another weird one.
Yep. Well, even Shenmue at the time was, like, pretty wildly different from whatever anyone had played before, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think Sega was ahead of its time in a lot of ways, and that sometimes played against them. But in the case of the game experiments, I think it was a bit of the fact that prominent game designers were treated like rock stars. If you made a game that was a hit, Sega would give you a lot of leeway to kind of do what you wanted. And as a result, we'd get games like Seaman. So Yute Saito was behind The Tower, aka Sim Tower, which was a very successful game. And then we got to see such delightful games like Seaman, which was a hit, actually. People loved it. I remember very distinctly when the game was soon to be released in the US, just walking through the QA area, and you just have this chorus of people saying, "Talk to me, Seaman, talk to me." And you hear the tap, 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 and just like somewhat miserable QA people just talking to Seaman and trying to bring him to life. But you times 50 people, it was pretty funny and amazing to witness.
That's fantastic.
And then Samba de Amigo was done by Sonic Team. So obviously, Sonic Team was a very revered team for obvious reasons. And so they wanted to do Samba de Amigo, and so they did it. And it was a pretty fun game on its own, but you said required, and I think you're right insofar as that it is a much, much better experience, more fun experience with the Maraca controllers, and was an intensely fun party game. You didn't even need four controllers. You just had one set of Maracas, and it was a party.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is Sega, before anyone else, understood that most parties were going to be most convenient in the gaming world played online, right? So, you know, maybe on a weekend you could get all your friends together, but every night you could have a party with online connectivity, right?
Definitely.
And it was kind of crazy to look at that decision to put a modem in every box, because that couldn't have been cheap. And it was a 56K modem, incidentally, right? Yep. You'd have to buy a broadband modem separately, and they were not easy to get. That now seems so obvious, but it was definitely not, you know, something that was obvious at the time. So what was that like? And I just also would love to know, how many people used it? Was it something that like 80% of people who had a Dreamcast would plug that thing in? Or was it a small audience you were hoping to grow? I just want to know what the thinking was behind that whole part of the Dreamcast.
I think a lot of it had to do with a competitive advantage. Sega certainly had a history of allowing consoles to go online, mostly as peripherals. So having it be the first console out of the box with internet coming from Sega makes a lot of sense. So I think, again, it's just an example of how forward-thinking Sega was as a company, is as a company. I do believe that Sega was a victim of its own cutting-edge nature in the sense that it tried to foist seemingly undesired additions, modifications to their consoles, like the 32X, on consumers, and in many cases, just releasing things too early for consumers to really get. So your average consumer was not really just getting online. You know, this is just at the right before the dot-com boom slash bust. So this idea of being online was kind of a new thing. You know, certainly, there were a lot of people that were already online, but in terms of your mass market consumer, not so much. And Sega spent a ton of money introducing and educating consumers to online gaming. I really think Microsoft benefited greatly in the launch of their Xbox Live from the groundwork that Sega laid, not to mention, no surprise, that several high-profile people from Sega did go to Microsoft, Peter Moore, Julia Miller, and that kind of led to their success.
Oh, right.
Microsoft's success in establishing a beachhead there.
Well, software, too. Phantasy Star Online came over to the Xbox exclusively for a while. NFL was over there. So, you know, a lot of the things that we were getting so excited about on Dreamcast carried over to Xbox. Mm-hmm. Shenmue 2.
Yep. There was definitely, and the Dreamcast ran Windows CE. So Sega and Microsoft did have a pretty cozy relationship for a long time. So it's not surprising to see some of the things from Sega kind of go over to the Xbox. Jet Set Radio also. Soon after I started Sega, I joined Sega.com, which was a newly created company formed from kind of the bones of SegaSoft, which was a subsidiary that was focused on developing software. Mostly PC games. They also had kind of an online community called Heat.net, which was pretty popular back in the day. So a lot of the employees from SegaSoft were folded up into Sega.com. I went and joined them, and we were responsible for the kind of networking side of the Dreamcast. So launched Sega.net, which was the ISP, which supported the Dreamcast in the US. We also were in charge of Sega.com, which was kind of the marketing vehicle but it served also as a functional extension of the Dreamcast. So you could go online with the Dreamcast, obviously, via the Planet web browser, and many games also had online functionality and connectivity. So for every kind of Flash-based site that we built for PC to promote games, we also had to create an HTML version that was accessible via the Dreamcast. I remember there's also a lot of cool functionality that you could do from the game. So for Jet Set Radio, I know it was called Jet Grind Radio here for legal reasons, but it'll always be Jet Set Radio in my heart. Mm-hmm. You could customize and upload your own graffiti for use in game, which is super cool. Such a cool concept. Quick sidebar. How controversial and cool was Jet Set as a game? I mean, it's a game about kids skating around and tagging up the city.
Yeah.
It received a ton of flack and for probably some good reasons. You know, you probably don't want to glorify people going and tagging buildings willy-nilly, but Sega really leaned into it. They created a graffiti as art contest to promote the intrinsic value of the art form, which is so cool for a company to do that, and kind of very smart from a marketing perspective as well, I think.
While at the same time being very risky, right? Because this, look at a game like that and so edgy. Many others. Edgy, but it's like, you could say it looked like it borrowed something from, say, Tony Hawk, right? Mechanically, but you definitely wouldn't say it's an imitator of Tony Hawk, right? Because you have the graffiti mechanics, you have the cops chasing you, you have the cel-shaded visuals, which became a popular thing only after Jet Set Radio. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it was synthesizing so many cool things, both from inside and outside of games, to create something you hadn't ever played before, right? Crazy Taxi is another great example. And I know that that came out in arcades, but it was Naomi architecture, so it ran perfectly and exactly the same way at home.
Yep.
And that was one of those games that is so fun and clever that it's obvious only in retrospect that a taxi game would be so fun, you know?
Yep. I remember there was a Crazy Taxi contest that was run, and they kind of had to, Sega had to kind of adjust the parameters of the winner because there was a unknown at the time exploit where you could maneuver your car into a, like up against a wall. And so you're basically kind of bouncing on one tire and just racking up insane amounts of money.
I didn't know that.
And so when they had the finals, they flew people in to play it. And I can't remember how many contestants there were. They'd race to that one spot and it basically just became a like competition to see who could get the most bounces before your time ran out kind of thing. So they had to kind of tune the parameters of the contest. It was kind of funny.
That's wild. Yeah, again, it's like that game was the first I ever saw with tie-in advertising that actually made the place feel more grounded. Remember like Levi's and Kentucky Fried Chicken and Tower Records, I think, was one of the things you popped
up. Tower Records was in there. Yeah, definitely some cool branding tie-ins that made sense, you know, because you're driving around a city and you see kind of city landmarks, which include storefronts. And also it was really cool to see a lot of San Francisco infused with some of these games. So certainly Sonic Adventure had that Sonic Adventure 2, I guess, with the hills and the skating or boarding, I guess, which I learned was an effect of the Sonic team being in the US. So Sega sent a section of the Sonic team to reside in the same building, 650 Townsend, as Sega of America. And we never saw them very often because they were kind of in their little thing working 75 hours a day or whatever. They just loved their work and threw everything into it. However, once I was in Tahoe and I ran into a couple of them in Lake Tahoe snowboarding. And so you could kind of see the things that they were actually doing while in America kind of bled into some of the games they were designing and building, which is really cool. And of course, it was cool to drive a taxi around the crazy streets and hills of San Francisco and not be concerned about rear-ending someone.
That's very fair. Yeah, and it is interesting because you're right. There was clearly a lot of inspiration that the Japanese teams were getting from either living in or visiting San Francisco. Yeah, and I do remember exactly where Sonic Team was in the Townsend building, and you had to get special permission to go in there and have a good reason for doing it. The time I went in to sit down and talk to Izuka-san and the team was trying to figure out how to make controls work for Sonic the Hedgehog on an iPod with a click wheel, right? And that's not easy. And it was interesting because they basically said, this won't be fun, but here's how we would do it if we were forced to. So...
Fair warning.
Yeah. It turns out they it was like a pixel-perfect port that Backbone, the team that's now Digital Eclipse, did beautiful. But yeah, controls were almost impossible.
Iffy at best.
Yeah.
Just to circle back around on what we're talking about with Sega in terms of innovation. It was just exciting to be working in a company that was so creative and so innovative ahead of its time. And you know, I think history's been kind to the Dreamcast. It was seen as a commercial failure, but I think a lot of people look back at it as one of the best consoles ever, and I'm inclined to agree with that sentiment. And I don't think it's just me, the fact that I worked at Sega for so long. It's just a great console that did so many things so well with so many great games. And I feel fortunate that so much of that creativity spilled into the work that we did on a day-to-day basis. So, you know, I worked with artists and highly technical people, which kind of sums up the games business at its apotheosis, really. So I really feel lucky to have worked with such a great group of people, yourself included.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. And I remember there were still some of the old Dreamcast posters up in the building. And one that I always loved to walk past was one that said, "Innovation over everything." Right. Mm-hmm. And it was a picture of Sonic, but they lived that and they were ahead in so many ways. So I know that with PlayStation 2, the big deal was that it was coming with the DVD player, right? At mm-hmm. the same time as Dreamcast saying, no, the modem and online is the future. I think we can see now that overall online is obviously much more important than packing in a media player for movies.
Sure.
But it was interesting because there's such a thing as being too far out.
Yep.
I think the other thing that's interesting to look at is we were talking about peripherals, right? The keyboard for typing the dead, you know, the maracas for samba, you know, and the microphone for C-Man.
The VMU,
yes.
The visual memory unit.
And that was so much fun, especially with Chow Garden, right?
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of presaged the idea of, you know, some games now where you're playing some function of a game on phone that carries over to your game, right?
Definitely. Yeah, so super ahead of its time. I think from NFL 2K, the ability to do your play calling on the VMU.
Yes.
So if you're sitting couch co-op, they can't see the plays you're calling. That's huge. It's such a game changer, right? It really makes the game so much more fun and so much more compelling. And it was such a cool little device. I mean, it really became almost like a fashion accessory. You have all these different colors and different themes. And it became, like you said, it kind of becomes an extension of the games that you're playing. You could take outside the game and do other things with. Very cool.
Well, you know, the other thing too is the fishing controller. And I wanted to talk about that for a minute because I love that. And
if you were to tell me 2 years prior to me being at Sega that I'd play over 25 hours of a bass fishing game, I would have laughed at you. But,
yep.
You know, with that controller, it made it so much fun.
Well, it was a major touch point for me and my dad. Because he didn't really care about video games. Like, when he had that controller in his hand, it kind of made sense. And here's something I think no one really talks about. Given all of these different peripherals, different approaches to playing, especially the fishing controller and the maracas, that kind of presaged Wii, right? The idea of motion mm-hmm. control and giving people something to put in their hands that wasn't 12 buttons and 2 sticks, right? Because yep. I think what people tend, when they play video games a lot, to forget is that learning how to use one of those controllers is not that different from learning how to type.
True.
You know how to do it after the fact. You don't even think about it. But beforehand, it's very intimidating. And yet, when you have these devices in hand, like maracas or fishing controllers, that's like having the Wii remotes, right?
Yep.
And so that's yet another place where Sega knew where things were going. They were just too early, you know?
Too early. And it almost hints at kind of VR in some ways, because it's this thing that enhances the digital experience, and that is a well-known thing outside of games, meaning a fishing rod. So people know how to use a fishing rod. In VR, some of those most interesting experiences are the very banal things that you can do in everyday life. And I think, you know, Sega doing that with bass fishing, and there was a marine version where you could catch marlin and stuff as well, but never as popular as the bass fishing one for some redneck reason. Yeah, so again, ahead of their time in a lot of ways. You know, the keyboard and mouse, I think, you know, obviously PC gaming has been around and was around long before Dreamcast came around, but you know, keyboard and a mouse with a console, pretty much unheard of, makes a lot of sense if you're releasing an online console that has online connectivity. But it also allowed for things like releasing Quake for the first time on a console and games like The Typing of the Dead,
yep.
which is just a really fun game that lets you type good and kill zombies.
Well, and that same brand, the House of the Dead with the light gun, right? Which, again, was arcade perfect. I remember when that game came out, again, the Japanese version, bought that right away. And eventually, I had moved from retail to a company called Ingram that was about to stock the Dreamcast and sell it to video stores all over the country. And we had an event at a Dave & Buster's where we were just doing a show of all the stuff that was coming from Ingram. And I ran the Dreamcast part of it to show that platform. And we set ourselves up with the Japanese Dreamcast version of House of the Dead right next to the arcade game at Dave & Buster's of House of the Dead, which was really fun because people could see in real time, look, this is literally the arcade at home. And it was. Yeah. It was indistinguishable and just every bit as fun, you know?
Yeah. It was... Great times.
Last thing I wanted to kind of touch on with this was the transition. So Sega eventually closed out the Dreamcast despite its popularity, despite the creative decisions the team made to produce games you've never seen elsewhere. What was that like? That must have been kind of a dark time internally.
Yeah, for sure. It was a tough bit of news to take on the chin, for sure. Everyone put so much work and effort into supporting these fantastic games and fantastic system. But at the same time, there was still a lot of work to be done. Sega wasn't fully bowing out, you know, not closing as a company, just changing their focus. And they still make and made amazing games. So we just changed our focus to supporting those games. And you're just focused on executing on that to a high level. So even though Sega was dropping out of the console biz, there were still amazing, talented devs making great games. I mean, I think there's a period of mourning, and then you start to see, within relatively short amount of time, a game like Super Monkey Ball come out.
Yes, GameCube.
Or come down. And that was a great little title. And you obviously have some affinity with it as well, which you can talk maybe a little bit about. But it came out on the GameCube, and it was such a great game that nestled really well into the Nintendo kind of brand proposition. So it really felt at home on the GameCube, and it was really, really kind of cool and inspiring to see Sega kind of pick itself up, dust itself off, and still continue to move forward, even with a different focus.
Well, I remember it was a very, very big deal when Virtual Fighter 4 came to PlayStation 2, and that was just getting tens across the board. It's like, the best fighter out there. And then talk about being comfortable accepting where you are and looking at past opponents as colleagues. I remember when I was a game journalist going to Hollywood and Vine for the launch of the GameCube and seeing Sonic Adventure 2 Battle running on a GameCube, right, was just absolutely crazy to me. Sonic on a Nintendo platform, seeing a Nintendo Power issue with Sonic on the cover, just absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah, so weird. And then fast forward to Sonic and Mario at the Olympics.
Yep. Well, and I have to say, a lot of people disagree with me, but first and foremost, if I was to name my favorite video game of all time, it would be Sonic the Hedgehog 2.
Wow.
I play that 4 or 5 times all the way through every year. I love it. I think it's better than any Mario game ever made. Fight me. Also, you look at the movies, and yeah, Super Mario Brothers, the movie, was fun, but it doesn't have Jim Carrey, right? And
true.
I actually think that those Sonic movies are more fun, too. So I'm glad to see that, at least from my perspective, Sonic come out on top.
Yeah, Sonic's doing great. Mario, still obviously no slouch.
Yeah, for sure. Well, really appreciate taking the time to hear from you on what your experiences were there, because as I said, it's like, it's one thing to see it as a fan and have a lot of speculation as to what was happening. It's another thing to talk to someone who actually was there in the thick of it.
Well, it was fun to dust off the cobwebs and reminisce about a long time ago. Again, really worked with some great people, and it was a fun time to be there, and did some really cool stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So just wrapping up for this first episode here, we wanted to talk a little bit about just favorite games from the Dreamcast era, since that's what kicked off the conversation. So if you had a top five, what do you think would make it in what order?
Top five. Well, Soul Calibur has to be up there because that was a launch title. It was just mind-melting experience the first time I played it. We played it a ton internally, just constantly had Soul Calibur tournaments. Yeah, I was a big fan of Ivy. Just so much fun. So many hours spent playing that game. Intensely.
Yep.
Fun. Skies of Arcadia is one of my favorite
RPGs. Oh, that is so good. So good.
Love that game. So endearing, such a great story, so cool mechanics, just a really, really great game. San Francisco Rush 2049, I'm going to put on there because we played a ton of the arena mode at the office. It was just so much fun to just drive around and have such cool weapons and really, really fun. Have a lot of fun memories of that. Crazy Taxi.
Yes.
I think because to your earlier point, it's such a faithful recreation of the arcade experience. It was just amazing to be like, I'm playing an arcade game on my television with this controller, and really cool bite-sized gameplay. So you could just hop in and drive around. But if you're really good, you could stretch it into a really nice session. So I think it translated really well from that kind of arcade coin feeding type mechanic design into a really cool, fun console experience. And then I think the last one would be NFL 2K. It was, I'm not a huge fan of American football, but it was such a cool experience to play online. It was just amazing as a console. We ran some really cool promotions internally. We had a SegaNet Bowl in which we flew the winner of an online tournament for 2K1, NFL 2K1, to the Super Bowl in Florida. And I got to work the NFL experience and kind of help educate people about Sega.net and online console gaming and stuff. So that title holds a special place in my heart.
Yeah, I can totally relate with that. I am not a sports guy, but I did buy that game at launch, and it was just because I knew my friends were going to want to play it, first and foremost, but also it just looked so damn good. It just was so mm-hmm. much better looking than anything you'd ever seen on the Nintendo 64 or the PlayStation, right? Just stunning.
Definitely.
So yeah, for me, my top five, I'm a narrative loving games as art pretentious person, so Shenmue comes first for me. Right.
Sure.
So what I loved about it's so sloppy, and there's so many things to pick apart with that game, but it was a game that saw the brass ring and it jumped for it, and it did everything it could, and was at the time the most expensive game ever made, to make you feel like you were living in someone else's shoes. So like the whole thing where you're
very immersive.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And when you are taking on part-time jobs and walking around town asking for people and playing with cats and stuff like that, it just made you feel like you were in Japan. And when you were then in a position where you're fighting someone or someone dies, it has huge impact because it's not happening every 3 seconds, right? It actually is meaningful and feels grounded. So that was a game I love so much that for a while I would play Shenmue and Shenmue 2 every year on Thanksgiving holiday, just to live that experience again. So that's my favorite by far. Soul Calibur is number two. It has to be, right? That thing, because if there's any game even now you'd pop open and play on your Dreamcast and you'd get several hours into, especially with friends over, it's that one. Just beautiful, incredible how well it stands the test of time. Number three would be Sonic Adventure for me, just because that was like my first taste of like, oh wow, this is what you can do, you know, in 3D, and you know, move beyond the simple but charming kind of aesthetic of Super Mario 64, right?
Yeah, it was a great transition from 2D to 3D for Sonic, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, super, super ambitious on top of that. The Ubisoft release Grandia 2 would actually be my equivalent of Skies of Arcadia. It's the first RPG I ever finished, actually. So back in the earlier days, Final Fantasy VII, I'd get into the hype cycle and buy them, but never finish them. There was something about Grandia 2 that just got me all the way through, and I absolutely loved it and went and played the first one on PlayStation, which I also didn't play all the way through. But Grandia 2 was the one, and love that. And then the last one I'd put on that list would be Crazy Taxi, just because, again, it was that example of, like, you can get perfect arcade experiences at home. I'm going to allow myself a runner-up just because I can't leave it to five, and that would be Street Fighter 3 Double Impact. You know, it got almost no attention over here, but it was a beautiful 2D fighting game, and I got the fighting sticks for it, and my friends had a lot of fun with it. And that was a hard game to find in arcades, but we didn't need to go there because the arcade perfect version was right there, right? But that would be my list. And again, like, I could go for a top 20, top 50, but we'll leave it at six.
Yes, we'll leave the top 50 for another show.
Yeah.
Cool. Great conversation. As always, nice to speak with you, and hopefully folks listening also enjoyed it. Again, we welcome any feedback you might have, topics you want to cover, and we hope to catch you soon.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
Cool. Thank you, Ethan. Bye, everyone.